Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how a genre gets made. I'm GMB Kamichuk, a working writer and illustrator, known to my friends as Gregory, so my long-suffering co-host calls me GMB. Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork, is here in studio today. He has gone on a long elevator ride, and he has come back and told me that he knows what we're doing on this episode. And so, dear listener, we will learn about it together.
Right now, yeah. It's not often we do a podcast with just you and me together.
I know.
With, like, there's no Dan in the room. Lyndon has set things up and run away. So if they're not set up correctly, Dan, it was Lyndon's fault this time.
Yeah, dear listener, so you know, any lack of sound quality in recent episodes is our fault. That's always because Dan is not present in the room. And you'll know because I haven't introduced him as being present. So if there's ever anything wrong, please blame Lyndon for that. Dan came into studio full dad mode.
We got yelled at.
He told us that we were really bad at it and that we have to be better if he's not going to be there. And so this one's for you, Dan. Yeah. We're going to do our best.
Well, you say that. Hopefully it sounds all right and not terrible.
Oh my God.
Your mic cut out 2 seconds after we started, but we don't know.
We don't know until it's too late. Oh my God, you can just hear me in the distance on your mic in the background.
Okay, so yeah, I was, we didn't really have a topic for today's podcast, so I went to grab a coffee and told everybody at the studio that I would have a subject by the time I got back. And so I was rolling around a couple ideas of what I'd like to talk about, what do I have things to say about, what would Gregory have things to say about, and some of our like current projects that we're both working on. There were some connections that I was seeing that we could both kind of go in on, but thinking about this podcast from the listener's viewpoint, from people who are listening and maybe wanting to get into what we're doing or get into art creating full time, that's the reason we created this podcast, right? We wanted the podcast to be the thing that we never had when we were starting out. The resource of information that nobody was talking about when we were kind of figuring it out on our own. And we both looked. We both tried to find.
We did.
Now exactly this podcast.
There's more of them out there.
It's still not very many. Like every once in a while, I'll look for podcasts talking about Artist Alley or doing conventions, and it's not. There's not a lot.
Yeah, not too prevalent. Most of the comics related podcasts are related to content reviews.
Yeah.
Or
news.
News related stuff. Yeah, which isn't sort of our thing. I try to think of this sometimes as, if this was a collection of recordings that could somehow be put in a bottle and put in the river of time and sent back to young Gregory, I'd appreciate knowing all these things. That's just how that's what's in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
And so that's how we think of you, dear listener. It's like someone that maybe could see a couple of jokers like us mess up a bunch and then learn from it and do different or better.
So thinking about, if I wasn't on this podcast, if I was a listener, something that I would like to hear about how it gets made, how that sausage is getting made behind the curtain. What I came up with was I wanted to talk about your workstations and your work schedule.
Oh, interesting.
But not just your current. I want to talk about it when we were both working full-time jobs.
Oh, like overtime.
What it is currently, what it looks like when you're in a crunch, what it looks like when you travel. Those kinds of variations. So let's start off with let's go in the rewind machine. Let's go back in time to when you were working a full-time job and you were creating on the side. What did your workstation look like and what did your work hours look like?
Well, you know, since I was a teenager, I have had a full-time job of some sort. Mm-hmm. And since I was a teenager, I also fancied that one day I would write stories that other people, that would be not just for me, but for other people as well, and hoped that that conversation of creator and audience and would exist. So that's been on my mind. So I preface my answer by saying I would go even farther back
okay.
than like professional Gregory with a salaried position.
Yeah, actually, great, great.
Back to, you know, I always had, so, okay, so this goes back to, God, what year was that? I worked as a houseman, which is like a glorified bellboy.
Okay.
Out at Panorama back where in my misspent youth.
Initiated a coup at one point.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's a story for another podcast.
You told that story on the podcast.
I don't know if I have or not. But so glorified bellboy. I always had these little coil-bound notebooks, and I carried them with me everywhere. And I found a bunch of them recently. This is why they're on my mind. Is I had just moved, so I found a bunch of this like archival material of mine, and flipping through it. Was it another interesting conversation for another time? When I was at work, any job, even a skilled labor position, that when you get good at it, it frees up RAM and you can think about other stuff. And so the things I liked to think about, you know, other people like to think about sports betting at that age, but I was thinking instead about science fiction stories. And so what I would do is I would write on these little notebooks snippets of dialogue or story ideas in no particular order on these little flip charts. They're very small. I didn't have a lot of, you know, it had to fit in my breast pocket.
Yeah, the pocket-sized ones. Yeah, yeah, the travel guidebooks, journals.
And I would do little doodles, and I was working on a science fiction epic at that time. Of course, everyone does. That's, if you're thinking about
Star
doing
Wars,
genre,
yeah,
everyone's
doing
this.
My Lord of the Rings. That's where everybody starts.
Yeah, so I was doing that and looking at just everyday things and writing them down. And so the only workstation I could have with me, literally, while I was at my regular job, was a little notebook that could fit in my pocket. And what I realized is how little I actually would go back and look at what was in those notebooks. Almost never at that time did I do it.
It was only forward momentum. It was only going...
I would always add stuff to it. And then whatever idea I had processed, I would then try to write out when I got home.
So this was mostly writing. There's not a whole lot of illustration.
That's right. I didn't have, couldn't really do illustration. And I was horrible at drawing at that point in my life. I liked drawing. I found a lot of solace in it, but I would not. And I did do a lot of doodles related to my stories, but at no point did I look at those doodles, those drawings, even ones I would spend whole days on, and think, oh, other people would want to see this too. It was 100% just for me at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think that typifies, if I'm thinking about it, just like under the microscope of your forced introspection now, something to carry with you that you'll work on when you get home has been my repeated, like, job, workstation, full-time job.
You were always chipping away at it. It didn't stay at home stay there until you got back to work on it. You took it with you, and you were always working away a little bit.
But you know me, I'm a notebook addict.
Yeah.
And so it's only in recent years where I have codified a useful working practice of, before I start a new notebook, I look through the old one,
yeah,
and then pull those ideas that I think are worth tinkering with into the new one, and I keep tinkering. I didn't have that habit then.
No.
It was just whatever was on your mind, you'd write down so you wouldn't forget, and then I often wouldn't check. Just writing it down meant I could remember it. It became like just the memory of writing it down was the file tree I needed to know that I did it. And then in that way, you know, it didn't really interrupt whatever job you were trying to do.
13 years have passed. 14. 15. 16. And then suddenly the light was gone. What had happened?
Do you ever get chastised for writing in this little notebook?
No, because it looked like, because at that time...
You looked like you were taking a note about something work-related. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was during the early days of, like, you're on camera at work. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, there was actual security, and, like, people thought the Big Brother vibe, that you really had it then, which, like, everyone takes for granted now, but it was new at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So writing in a little notebook as a person whose job it is to run between buildings and get people what they need, totally
perfectly
fine.
Acceptable.
Yeah, perfectly acceptable. But it also wasn't the kind of job where you could do anything more than write a note. Like, I was always in motion, running and solving some problems. So there wasn't anywhere to hide where you could There wasn't a lot of theft of services going on. The best you could do
you
is
were
like,
busy.
Yeah,
you were busy.
Knock down and jot down an idea. But when I worked at the group homes, later I started working in group homes and working with youth services and stuff related to that. At-risk youth, I guess, is the term they use, but don't really like that term. There was a lot more downtime where you were supposed to model sort of proper behavior. So if the kids were supposed to do their homework,
you'd be working as well.
You were encouraged to do the book work related to keeping the receipts and like, because you know, in that group environment, you run the house, right? So you buy the groceries, you do it on a budget, you have to like, so you model how to run a home to the kids. But when I'd be finished, and I could finish that work very early, they'd still be working on their homework. And so I'd work on it. They'd say, "What are you doing now, Mr. C?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm going to work on a story." Right.
So at this point, how old, like early 20s?
Yeah, early 20s by that point.
Like the things you were working on, did you think they were going to be published one day, self-published? You were going to pitch them? Or
Never.
Were they just, they're just you being creative for creative sake?
Well, and let's be clear. The part of me that would daydream about and fuel the ego would say, yeah, this is for some big idea one day. Mm-hmm. But the part of me that knew myself knew how far I had yet to travel on that journey before it was good enough.
Right,
for
you
that.
Weren't ready to show your work just yet.
And I wanted people to see it and ideas I thought were good and snippets I thought were good, I would workshop with people or share with people I trusted or didn't trust in some cases. But I didn't have a community around me. I didn't have peers who were interested in that way, and I didn't have mentors with the appropriate skill sets.
You didn't even have
time.
The internet to go try and find these people, right?
That's right.
This is
literally went to the library.
Yeah.
I tried publishing a couple of short stories. I would get rejections at that time, and I wouldn't stress about it because even as I sent it out, I knew it had a long way to go.
Right. But your journey had started.
It had started, but I was it was also, I think, a little bit of a mental health thing, too. It's like, that's how I relieved my stress.
Yeah.
Creatively, right? If it was a bad day or was a lot of stuff. And, like, a group home was the kind of place where you were witness to a lot of bad behavior. You were the barrier to protect young people from a lot of bad behavior. And so you could take a lot of that work home with you if you weren't careful. And so the way I was careful not to was I would make sure that I had my writing schedule would be something I would do. On the way home, I'd stop at a coffee shop and I'd write. It would have nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the job, nothing to do with those things, but just that heightened state I would just put somewhere.
Right.
Right. And then I
would, that was your creative outlet.
Yeah, that was my creative outlet. And so it's definitely served. And I haven't thought about this in, 20 years.
Wow.
So.
Dragging up the past.
Yeah,
here.
Dragging up the past.
Okay.
And then I will give credit now. I remember the moment I was working. I told myself I'm working on a novel. And this was the thing that would eventually become the Imagination Manifesto. But this was years before it was that. I was working on a novel and I was at a coffee shop. And a friend that worked there introduced me to Steven Erikson of the Mazatlan Books of the Fallen stuff. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, I would read, you know, if you got something you want to show me, I'd happily give you some feedback." And I remember saying, "Oh shit. Now I have to consider a different audience than the one I imagine." And I remember that feeling of, I better really look at this from a professional point of view. And I remember being like super stressed out in a way that my job could never make me feel. And that was actually a real strong indicator for me that it mattered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, I really want to be good at this. And so when I gave him a section of it to read, and to his credit, he did read it and give me some feedback. And I've since found that also in the archive.
Oh, wow.
And I reread what I had sent. Oh, God. He was so generous with what was some.
He could probably tell from the interaction how close to the heart this was.
Right. Or maybe not. But I asked him for real feedback and he gave me real feedback.
Okay.
And I remember asking him, like, do you think I'm ready to like look for an agent or whatever? And just like not missing a beat. He just said no. Right. He's like, no, you got a lot of pages left to do before you're ready for that. And that was one of the first times, there were others, but that was in my mind, a really important watershed moment of a person that I actually didn't know, had no social capital built up with. Mm-hmm. I just knew that they had the job that I thought I wanted.
Were they a full-time writer at this
point? Oh, yeah. Full-time writers were writing there every day.
Yeah.
Right? He had a 10-book deal with Tor at that time. Okay, not Tor, a UK publisher. He ended up selling reprint rights, I think, to Tor later. But he was the real deal.
Yeah.
And was treating me like a peer because he saw me showing up every day and doing the shovel work.
It's the important part.
Right? And so I think that's why he was generous with his feedback, is because I wasn't just someone who talked about writing. He would sit across and for 5 hours I'd be tinkering and he'd be tinkering and then, you know.
At this point in time, was it complete, like, was it physical? Like, you guys were both writing in notebooks, or did you have a laptop at this point?
I had a laptop.
You had a laptop, then. Yeah.
Yeah, one of those huge,
black
old,
one,
heavy
the
ones.
Clackety, yeah.
Yeah. Clickety-clackety laptop. Oh.
But what was this? Weird sounds all around me. What could it be? My curiosity compelled me to stop.
I think the important moment for me, a good watershed moment, was after I had worked on it for a long time more, rather than print out a whole bunch of the book again and say, hey, Stephen, can you look at this? I remember just a very, it was just a very casual moment. Like, he was up on his way to get another Americano. And I turned the laptop and I said, read this paragraph and tell me if you think this is moving in the direction that is related to the notes that you had originally given me. Like, is this the right thing or not? And he just casually read it. And then he looked at me and he said, yes, this, exactly. Exactly right. This. And, you know, I mean, for the dear listener, most of those notes were related to brevity, not over-explaining certain elements of the genre, just trusting the character to say the right thing. Those were the kinds of stuff I was kind of tinkering with in my nascent phase.
And I don't remember how we got to this next, but we talked about you drawing on backers, comic book backers.
Yeah, because you asked me if prose writing was...
You weren't in graphic novels yet. You weren't ready to get into prose writing.
Yeah, and right around that time, I was drawing on comic book cardboards. I found, for whatever reason, a stack of old, you know, when you're a comic collector, these are always around, a bunch of old cardboards. I didn't want to throw them out, and I started drawing on them. And just the pen I was using at the time, these... some ballpoints, but also, I can't even remember, some... It was a pilot something.
Right. Just the way it glided over that.
Just the way it glided. It seemed so effortless. And so then I started drawing on that stuff. And I was just constantly aping Ramon Perez's style because I was a big mark for all the Palladium role-playing games. And he had a bunch of spot illustrations in there. And I had the great pleasure of telling Ramon Perez this exact story.
That I tried to
basically
copy
like,
for years and years.
Thanks for drawing all those. You know, I asked him, we were at the raid party, I think, in Toronto, which they host, and he was a consummate host. And I just said, you know, thanks for inviting me to the party, but also, thanks for illustrating all those Palladium books back in the day. He's like, oh, yeah. He's like, I got paid maybe $50 or something to do those. And I said, well, copying those is why I'm doing what I'm doing. I loved Mike Mignola. He was also publishing at the time, but his style was unassailable to me.
Right.
It was too reductive. I didn't have the
you
skill.
You have to get like almost learn how to do photorealism and learn all the concepts and like learn so much to be able to bring it down to something that simplistic.
Yeah.
Right?
And Ramon had this great style, and he still does. His style has evolved quite a bit, but even then, it really works in black and white. The way he spots his black and the way that he... and I didn't know how to do it because I didn't work with a brush or anything like that. But the quality of the line to make the character feel fully real, even in black and white, it was awesome. Anyway,
right.
I was...
We're getting off topic. We're back to... I'm in charge today, so...
Oh, yeah, right. Sorry.
Back to
workstations.
Work hours. So this point in your career, you're starting to draw again.
Yeah, drawing all the time again, and mostly for role-playing games for my regular weekly group. That's what the illustration output was for. I'd come up with a wild monster, a wild setting, a weird map.
And you had to redraw the same character twice. This is where the conversation had...
Well, yeah, this is where we lost our foot. Yeah, so what had happened was I had gone back to reintroduce a character that I had shown to my a Wednesday night group then, and I thought I'll redraw that character and that'll be the surprise. If they recognize them, cool, then they'll get the, I'll let them roll for an insight, and if they don't, then it's going to catch them by surprise. So I went to look at the old drawing and I was so shocked at the difference in my own style, and because at that point I was trying to sort of show 5 to 10 illustrations a week for like a year, so then that's like whatever 52 times 5 or 10 was, it was starting to pile up in
right
really
thousands of illustrations. Which like my whole company mission statement revolves around this, like disgust at your old work, right? You improve and improve as long as you're as long as you're practicing, like you're it's in small chunks, but when you look at something from a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it's blatant how much better you've become.
Yeah. Or, and you know, I use very different tools now with digital stuff, or but I've come back around to doing a bunch of stuff by hand, and that's sort of interesting. So when we're talking about workstations, though, the through line here is I always had a place where I wrote down a rough idea, and then I had a place where I refined that idea outside of work.
You were always, you had that note app open at all times, even back in the day when it was not a note app.
Yeah, but it was just a physical place to write it down. Right. And I found when I was recently moving a box that I had labeled, maybe these are good ideas. And I had, when I was living in St. B, this was when Tara and I were first getting together, and I would be writing stories. Whenever I started a story and didn't finish it, I would just throw it in this box. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't feel like finishing it, I didn't stress about finishing it, which is a bad habit, I will point out now. It's better to finish it.
Finish, not perfect.
Yeah, better to finish
Sam Biko often quotes.
But also then you're practicing the full form of a story, the beginning, middle, and the end.
Yeah.
They all need practice. So I found this box of all these old stories recently, and it's amazing how many of them are the same story started over and over and over and over, because I had nothing. I really didn't have anything to say.
That tune you can't get out of your head or something.
Yeah, it's a tune, but I also didn't have anything to say, so I was just practicing craft instead of message.
Or maybe it's because you never finished it that you kept, your mind kept coming back to
it.
Yeah,
maybe.
Maybe.
So yeah, I didn't have like a regular workstation. It had to be portable. It had to come with me where I went. It had to come with me on my days off. It had to go where I was going. And so much of my current workflow still is informed by that. Like, I would much rather have a laptop than a desktop, even to do digital work, even though it's harder. It doesn't run as smoothly.
But let's not jump too far ahead, because what I think the listener is really wanting to know is, let's go into the part of your career where you are a full-time teacher, you're a dad, and you're still getting stuff. You got a couple of books done on the side.
I did one or two every year that I was teaching. So
Yeah. Like, how did that work?
For 10 years.
Talk about, your what you were using for your work and how the schedule.
So what I was using for my work was still a laptop then. Mm-hmm. I had a separate laptop.
Didn't have a Cintiq or any of that. Sketchbook and laptop.
In those days, a scanner.
Oh, God, I'm so glad that's not a part of our
life anymore.
Yeah, hated scanners.
Oh, the scanner. But I was on a Mac and the school wasn't. So, like, I couldn't use the same computer for both things. And that actually created this wonderful partitioning in my, if you want to call it, work-life balance. The work that I was doing, that I was being paid to do as an educator, was very partitioned from the work I was doing that was for me. And actually, I found that to be very helpful.
That's good. So every time you opened up that laptop, it was like going into a wonderful, fun world where no stress and everything's great. And
you know, in my time, a berry that size would have been big news all over the civilized world.
Division email would only work on a division computer.
Right.
It still does. You know, you can download it on other things now, but division, which meant nothing from my job
existed on that computer.
Existed on the other computer.
It's probably a smart way to do things.
Right. And my personal email was completely separate than my teaching email as a result, even in those early email days, as a result of that. Right. And so none of the attachments. And so, like, when I left teaching, people were like, oh, what about all your stuff that's in the archive and your emails and all that kind of stuff? I was like, well, what do you mean? The only stuff I have in there is, like, for work. You know,
you should be taking any of that with you.
Right. But anyways. So many people would mix, you know, they mix their personal and professional correspondences.
Yeah.
Through whatever email they have access to. And so that was a really sort of pleasant part of having everything separate.
So you had your laptop and you would you get to school early to get work done? Would you work over lunch hours?
So I tried really hard in my teaching career not to borrow from my teaching day for myself. So I would get there early and I would write whatever I wanted to, whatever was on my mind, I'd write early. It didn't have to be following up. Like if I had a new idea, fresh from dreaming, I would get to school before the kids would get there, often before the administrators would get there, and I would work on whatever I wanted.
Just sit in your classroom and
But I'd be on my laptop, which was also kind of great.
Yeah.
Because then I would look up and I'd see, oh, now it's time to get ready for school. And I'd have to close that work, right? Turn it off and then go and sit at the other workstation. And so it made it very easy for me mentally to partition those two practices. I can't speak to people who commingle everything. I can't personally. I wouldn't have been able to.
And computers are making it more and more commingled. Like you know, you log on to a new computer. I just got a new computer and Chrome wants to like update to my
everything
else.
Do.
Yeah. Which in some ways is great. In some ways, like I kind of want a fresh start. I don't want this to be the exact same carbon copy of the old computer.
And then we can debate the pros and cons of that. But for me, in that workstation mode, it meant when I was working on my books or my graphic novels, that's what I was doing.
Yeah. So you had a very clear division of work and play.
Yeah. And I also made a point of, in order to make that time possible, whether you know it or not, listener, teachers get spares and prep periods just like students do, and you're supposed to do your marking and your actual preparation in those preps. That's not really the done thing. Most teachers use that time to do a little, you know, quote-unquote professional development. They'll talk to another teacher. They'll, like, go to the admin. They will look at other ways to use that time, sometimes in the break room, whatever. I was a little bit ruthless. If I was on a prep, it was to prep for class. And so I did all my marking, all my prep during that time. And my
you didn't socialize?
In 10 years of teaching, I did not take marking home. That was my rule. Because I grew up in a house where my mother had been overburdened by the marking that came home. I saw its effect in life creep. And I did not want that to be in my life at all. And so I really hustled every day to make sure that I had time to, you know, I did my 9 to 5 so that I could work my 5 to 9.
Right.
Right. And I really gave it my all so that I wouldn't have to think about it when I got home.
And at this point, when you're in your career, do you have like a dedicated space at home to, for creative work as well? Or was it just kind of where kitchen table, couch, wherever?
Yeah. At that time it was sort of wherever, because Tara and I were just, you know, we were living together at that time and she is a busy person, and so I had plenty of time where she was off on an adventure of her own where we weren't doing it together, so it didn't impact. When I really needed a room and a tighter writing schedule was after kids arrived.
Right.
Because then it's necessary. Otherwise if you don't say I'm going to take this hour, but then when the doors open, all bets are off. And when the door's closed, right, you have to use that time.
Right.
You can't mess around because you only have an hour.
What if you don't feel like it? What if the muse isn't there right then?
I learned through teaching. I learned through that regular salary job where I was trying not to steal services while I was at work that the muse was, it was like a tag team match. I could tag them in when I wanted.
Right.
Right. And the easiest way to get the muse to arrive was to just start.
Okay. So this kind of setup carried on to the point where you decided to stop teaching and do this full time. Had this kind of schedule division of work and play, had that really changed, evolved in any significant way?
I remember when I needed to buy a bunch of hard drives because I had too many works in progress for publishers for my laptop to handle.
Right.
Having all of it on the actual
especially back then, laptops rig. Lots of high-res photo files, InDesign files. You had to get some external memory to cope.
Yeah, and so I know that. So then it would became you brought the hard drive that you needed as well
this
as...
This project's on that hard drive, that project's on that one, hard drive. On that one.
So that was a big change to the workstation, was needing room for it. And then also at that time, high-res photography and copy stands. A copy stand is basically just a rig where you have proper lighting and you have digital camera over top of it, and you're taking a picture of the artwork instead of scanning it.
Yeah, a little bit easier.
Still annoying. Still annoying, but that was happening. So you needed more. I just needed more hard drive space. And I remember thinking, I can remember thinking when I had like three hard drives in my bag, and this is back in the day when those were like big, right?
And your laptop's heavy too.
Heavy laptop, extra hard drives, taking that to and from so that I can do my morning work. I remember thinking like...
Something's got to give.
I bet computers are going to get a lot better.
Right.
Because everyone was doing that. Like everyone I knew who had their own computer that was doing any kind of like... It was just billing. So it was just... This is just a...
I remember writing dozens and dozens of disks.
Oh, and like, disks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, disks.
And then sometimes you'd buy the wrong kinds of disks, so your computer can't write that project to that disk.
Oh, man. See, we're of a different vintage. I remember floppy disks.
Oh, I remember floppy disks.
I had stories on floppy disks from like middle school that I transferred onto those hard disks that then I transferred onto a hard drive that then I still have copies of them right now.
Okay, so we must be getting around 2010, 11, 12,
yeah, somewhere
13,
in there.
Somewhere
now.
In
yeah.
there, right? Yeah. Clearly your side hustle, I know you don't like that term, but your side projects are starting to become a bigger and bigger part of your life.
And let me just reiterate why I don't like it for the dear listener. I don't like the idea of your side hustle because your day, everyone's got the same day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should do in your day a number of things that are good for you and good for other people. They should be good for your career and they should be good for your mental health. And you should just try to do those things every day. The byproduct of one of my good mental health practices, which was writing and illustrating, I ended up, let's quote Bob Ross, right? Talent is just pursued interest.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pursued interest that was yielding better and better results to the point where people were asking me, they'd see it and ask me to do it for them.
Right.
And so I had to figure out how to charge
for it. Now you were getting freelance.
Right. That was the birth of freelance. But I wasn't really seeking freelance. I didn't have a website. I didn't do any of that. People would just see me. And because I often worked, this is actually a good point about the workstation. Primarily at that time, I worked in restaurants or coffee shops. I worked out of the home.
So you're getting cold calls. People were like coming into your...
Into my office.
Into your office.
People would walk past me at a restaurant or coffee shop. And they would see that I turned it into a workstation with a laptop and a bunch of artwork and some drafts, which wasn't really a done thing.
Right.
But I didn't care about what other people needed. I would find that restaurant that was between school and home and spend a couple hours there doing whatever revisions were absolutely essential because they had to be sent off the next morning.
Mm.
So it wasn't a question of now I'm going to get home and then do it. I couldn't afford the distraction even then. Under that tight schedule. So I would just turn these public places into my private spaces to work.
Interesting.
And so a lot of people would walk by and say, oh, what are you doing? Like servers obviously would always be interested. And I would say, like, I'm going to probably be here for a couple hours. I'm happy to buy two meals, like whatever is necessary to make this okay so you don't get in trouble. That's how I'd rent my office space.
Right.
Didn't you hear the air raid siren?
You mean the horrible screeching?
It wasn't constructed for its aesthetic value, young man, but to warn silly young fools like you to get into the shelter. Now, come along, come along.
But I'm perfectly comfortable here, Mr. Philby. I've got to talk to somebody. This is fantastic.
That's where a lot of freelance work came about, was people were
completely organic.
Oh, this is what you do? Yeah. Hey, could you do this for me? Here's a card, here's a whatever. And I guess partially because I was going to nice restaurants isn't the right word, but there was a business crowd. There's a business clientele that was also stopping there after work for drinks. And so it was people, you know, who were used to hiring other people to do graphic design stuff that would tend to walk past. And it got to the point where I started switching places because I didn't want to go places where people would ask me or follow up on the job they'd hired me to do. Right? So that was a, like, now that I think about it, that was a real, that was a important part of my work process.
But I guess also kind of comforting to know that there is a demand and there are people willing to pay for this kind of thing, right? That
was comforting, but it was less comforting than you'd think.
Because people wanted you to do their thing.
Yeah.
Not your own.
Yeah. And usually, and we've talked about this on the show also, if someone needs you to do an illustration, it's different than if they need you to do it in your way.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Especially early on, that is usually the case. Oh, they don't want your voice.
Yeah. Do you do logos?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. No. I mean, I can do a logo, but I don't want to.
You've got a great logo. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Because it was for the right person.
That's right. So, and I have done them in the past, but I don't really want to do them now. Mm. Yeah, so as far as the workstation goes, portability has always been a key feature, and that has carried over to our convention life.
Okay, yeah, so let's get into conventions, because right around this part of your journey, conventions...
I had a full-time job, and I was doing 10 shows a year.
Did you start off, like, did you do one, or your first year
Yeah, first that I did one, and then I did two, and then I did five, and then I did 10.
You ramped up gradually. Would you say, like, you were still, like, 50% computer, 50% sketchbook? Like, are you still dividing your efforts between the two at this point, or...
I've never not carried a sketchbook around.
Yeah. It's not like, oh, I have computers now, I never need to jot in a sketchbook again.
Just how my brain works. I like to, think of the cliche of the mathematician with the long calculation on the huge blackboard, right? And he's showing their work. Showing their work. They're putting it all there. That's how I like to actually construct my stories, is a bunch of different variables all laid out in a mess. And then I narrow down on it. So I can't do that as fluidly, digitally, as I'd like.
Right.
So until that tool emerges.
Yeah, I can't. I always saw it as like freeing up RAM. Mm-hmm. Like as soon as I got it in my sketchbook, then it's kind of, it's down. It's no longer a priority, so I can move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't jot it down, if I don't get in the sketchbook, then it still has to, it just adds to the clutter in there.
I wonder though, if part of that is, because I'm just thinking now, my mood congruency meter is pinging. The sketchbook is the partition from the work that I have to do. So when I open the laptop, there are a bunch of necessary jobs. There's emails to check, but there's also drafts to finish. Mm. There's highlights. There's the real, the heavy duty work that is the job.
Yeah.
And so what I'm doing in my sketchbook is not unlike what I was doing when I would go to my job and work in the mornings and work after work. It's my time, whatever I feel like doing. This is for me. I'm going to do this for me.
Yeah.
And so the sketchbook occupies...
You still have that partition.
I have a partition I have these... My God, I was just totaling. I have these 7 sort of crucial things that are all supposed to happen in the next 8 weeks. And those are all on the laptop.
Right.
In my nice red sketchbook right now are a bunch of things that are just for me.
Only fun feelings.
Only fun feelings.
Yeah, only rosy gold nice things in the sketchbook.
Yeah, okay, this is the super duper sketchbook right now, where it's like only for me fun feelings and good drawings. Good drawings, fun feelings. That's all that's here in this sketchbook. And this doesn't have anything to do with my commitments.
Okay, interesting, right? Because I have like a good mixture in my sketchbook. How many sketchbooks do you typically carry around?
So I usually keep a day planner, physically.
So that's more the business.
Yeah, it's the business. But that's everything. That's like
everything.
My kids' play practice, my book launch, my email, the meeting I have to have with the school, whatever's happening. That's all in there, so that you can keep the worldview. That's the responsibilities of a dad, a publisher, a creative writer. It's all in there.
Yeah.
And then I have a notebook that is whatever I need to scratch out or think about. That's this red one. And then I usually have something floating around either on my desk or on my desk at home that is just whatever you feel like it. And we've just rearranged the studio here to, and it's really great. It really fits this. When I take this book that's just for me, I'm on break.
Right.
I leave my phone. I leave my everything. It's just me and this book.
Sirius Gregory does not have access to that book.
The Sirius Gregory, yeah. The Gregory that has things to do on hold.
Yeah.
The Gregory that has things that he wants to think about, things that have no stakes at all except his imagination there in that
That's
one.
That's his book.
And I usually have one of those with me at all times.
When conventions started to become a thing, so now suddenly you have a audience that is coming to a booth that you've set up, covered in your posters at this point. You have at least one book.
Yeah. Oh, this is back in the early days. Okay, yeah.
I don't want to jump too far ahead.
So my first convention vibe. So I also used to separate in my mind how I was supposed to behave at a literary convention versus how I'm supposed to behave at a Comic-Con. Because my first training for Comic-Cons was San Diego Comic-Con, I was like, I'm going to do Comic-Cons. So I'm going to go to the place where Comic-Cons are. It's the Comic-Con.
And you went there because, like, obviously you're a fan of comics, but, like, you wanted to, I want to sell comics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is creative development. Right. I want to do this. If I'm going to do this, I have to go
where
people
the big
are
boys
doing
are playing and see what they're doing.
And be humbled.
Right.
Right? Oh, man, I had a business
Were you
card.
Humbled?
Oh, yeah. I was humbled. But it was also so exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so then coming back with, and that's what you
just
were referring
to. For a scope,
to.
Do you have any idea the size of it back then to the size of it now? Any guesstimations?
In my mind, because I was so inexperienced, it's the same
it's
size.
Yeah.
Right?
I think it's been bonkers for a very long
time. Yeah, it's been bonkers for a long time. But it was my inexperience made that one. Even in my mind, that first one is bigger than the ones we've been to recently, which I know on paper are much larger. Right? It was just where I'm at.
Is going to look up really quickly. So that was the 2007?
It's got to be 2007, 8, or 9.
Because
maybe
2008
was
my first convention. I thought it was yours as well.
2008 was probably my first Winnipeg convention.
Right.
And I had worked on The Dark at that point, on that science fiction pilot. Dear listener, back before we had cell phones.
The San Diego Comic-Con. In 2007, had 125,000 attendees.
So half the size it was this year.
Right, but in my mind, enormous.
Enormous.
And 2008 and 2009 are both listed at 126,000, so roughly the same size.
Wow.
So whichever year that was.
Yeah. But young, inexperienced Gregory, who had never been to a room with that many people in it in his life, a couple of things happened. My God, I have to practice. I have to figure this out. There's a lot to learn, but also there are so many people
just
who I
like
can
you.
Ask. Yeah. Like there are so many people.
Because prior to this, you hadn't had access to that many peers.
That's right. And I was a big Kabuki fan at that time, like David Max, independent comic. And he was there and I got to talk to him and I showed him some of my work.
And it turns out he's a normal guy.
Yeah, he was pretty straightforward, normal guy. And right. He was like, wow, this is very different. I think it would work. You just have to do it yourself. Like that was his direct feedback. And I said, well, why would you say that? Shouldn't I find a publisher? He's like, well, look, all these Kabuki things, no one would publish this because they said it was too weird.
Right.
But didn't mean it wasn't in me to make, and it didn't mean that people wouldn't like it.
So is he responsible for your first self-published book?
No. Well, at that time, I went and found all my greats, right? I was, I went and found Kirkman that first show. I went and saw David Mack. I saw Bendis. I saw all these. Yeah, Mike Mignola I met at that show too, and these were all people that I was holding in this high esteem as they know how it all works.
Right, they have it all figured out.
Yeah. And then I met them and I realized, and they would say, oh no, we never know what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? All we know is what we can do. Mm-hmm. What I can do is I can make this story. What happens after that is often not up to you unless you make it up to you. And so the thing that I was doing differently at that time than what they were doing is I was convinced that there was no need for another publisher if you could get access to the distributor.
Right.
Right. The only thing that the publishers had then was access to Diamond Catalog, which was the only distributor at that time. So if you could get in there, that's all you needed. And I focused my efforts on making a book that would convince Diamond that they should carry it, not convince publishers that they should publish it.
Right.
And I had found a number of people who had done that. Like back in those days, Paul Pope had his Horse Press. And I didn't know at the time that Horse Press was him.
And you just had to put it under a different name?
Right, yeah. And it's 'cause just what you had to do. So I had seen all these creatives who seemed to be published by these publishers that only published them.
But it was just, in fact, them.
Right? And it took longer than it should have, dear listener, for me to realize, like, oh, they're just betting on themselves. I see what's happening here.
Do you have books?
Books?
Yes, we have books.
Oh, wonderful. I can learn all I want about you from books. Books will tell me what I want to know.
So is this where Alchemical Press came from?
That's where that started, yeah.
But there's something like it's that branding too, like Alchemical Press. And I remember like when I first, you know, was introduced to you and I saw your book and on it was Alchemical Press. And I assumed that was a room full of like 12 people all working away at this project on that book and the next book. Like
12 personalities for sure, right. But only one person, yeah.
But yeah, there's something about that branding that makes it seem more than just, you know, GMB Productions, GMB.
Yeah, and that was the other thing too is I think it might have been Eric Powell at that time when I think I met him after the show. Something Felipe too I met that time. But the reason I'm bringing it up is they both said similar advice. If you self-publish, don't do it under your own name. Make up a name. Make up a name because eventually you'll incorporate. And so you don't want to incorporate your own name. You want to incorporate the company. And maybe you want to help someone else publish their thing.
Right.
And if you're going to be a publisher and you might publish someone else's, they don't want to publish under your name.
Yeah.
So come up with
keep it a little broad. Yeah. Keep it for a little all broad. Those reasons looking forward.
And I even then had lots of ideas and lots of projects that I wanted to do. So my logo at that time was that 10 armed octopus, right? So much to do that 8 arms was not enough.
Yeah,
to added 2 more tentacles.
Okay, so at this point you are still teaching full time.
Yeah.
You were starting to do conventions.
No, at that time I wasn't even teaching. No, I must have been. Yeah, I would have been. Yeah.
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 So you're teaching, you're doing conventions, the work schedule has remained about the same, but now you have different venues and opportunities to get that work out.
Yeah, and as soon as I had that work out in a hardcover format, all the other opportunities started to just fall in line right after that. And that's
so
where
not just freelance, but other book projects. Publishers came a-calling.
Yeah.
Some good, some bad.
Some good, some bad, but what happened was I had, and it was right then, when this mantra that you've heard many times, dear listener, that movement gives shape to form, that's where it first hit me.
Right.
And that's where I first started repeating it to myself over and over again, because I had made the book, and that book, now that it existed, proved to other people that he can make books.
Yeah.
And it was just one part of a number of things I wanted to do, and I recognized now I could do it. And when people said, oh, you want to be a writer or an illustrator, what have you done? I could put it in their hand, and even if it wasn't what they were looking for,
you had accomplished it. You'd finished. You'd made the physical thing.
Yeah,
yeah. This 9 out of 10 of those conversations go, yeah, I want to be a writer. I want to make a comic. And you ask, okay, what have you done? Yeah. And the answer is usually nothing yet.
Yeah,
or I've got lots of ideas.
And back in those days, a good watershed, a good like way to differentiate between a self-published book and one that was legitimate, traditionally published, I guess is a better way to think about it. Not the hardcover, the ISBN.
Oh.
That's what people would look for.
If it didn't have an ISBN.
Yeah, it was probably, in those days, it probably was just self-published. It didn't have an international like book number, right? And so you could tell. You'd look at a book, you'd be like, oh, there's
only...
How
did you get them back? Like now there is a very convenient website for Canadians to go register.
And it had just started.
Okay, so
that's how I got it.
Okay.
Just right at the time when it had been digitized and you could apply for it as a
regular Canadian.
Yahoo
search for how do I make an ISBN?
Oh my God, probably was Yahoo. Yeah, that's so true. Oh my goodness. And found a government website. And it was like, if you're a Canadian citizen, you're entitled to these. every other website was like, it costs you this much money to get them.
Probably American websites.
Yeah, they were. And I was convinced that mine was not going to work.
Right, because it's free.
Couldn't be free. Yeah. How could it be? How could, what?
Yeah.
That's where you start to realize the differences between Canada and the U.S. in many aspects of the arts.
Okay, so bring us up to you quitting your full-time job and going full-time. Like, was, and I'm trying to think if there was something in your schedule that made that happen. Was there, like, you know, a final nail in the coffin that was like, I can't do both of these?
Yeah, you know, I don't mean to call you out on your, on the metaphor you just used, but the final nail in the coffin was actually my mother's passing away. So yes, there was a nail in the coffin.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. But no, it's all good. And I know your origin story, so I should have known. So I
no, it's fine. So dear listener, a couple of things happened at the same time. My mother had gotten very ill, passed away, reminding me that the real cost of anything is the time you spend on it. But I'd also been offered 3 different graphic novel projects, all of which I wanted to do.
But you did not have the time to do 3.
It was impossible. Yeah. It was impossible to do them all. And they weren't like monster fighting books. I had a publisher that wanted my monster fighting book. And I had another publisher that wanted a completely different kind of thing.
Superhero book?
No,
no, that was your monster one.
It was looking at the very real situation going on in Canada at that time of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children. And I pitched to be part of that project and was accepted. So now I had this. And then another project came in as a result of meeting Dr. Gillian Horton that was for the university doing a book about the real emotional cost of a life in medicine. So I had all these things I didn't want to say no to. And the only place I could scoop time from was work. And I remember going home having the nascent idea that I would quit my job, which I loved.
And this hadn't really come because
never.
You loved your
job. I just
job.
Loved it. I just so
and
good.
And you were making it work.
Yeah, it was working. I was putting out a book or two a year every year. I was able to go and do shows that I wanted to do. I had a really supportive administration that did not get in the way of those other things and saw them as added value. And there was no reason
to quit.
And I just so dearly, and I mean, anyone who's been listening to this podcast knows I've had 1 foot in education since I left anyway. I had a meeting with the school today about coming to do some work with them. So that's where my heart is. But at that time, I remember having the thought. In fact, I remember I was in the art room, which had become my room. It was now Mr. C's room. And I had finally reached that pivotal state where, like, I controlled the art room. It was the job I coveted for so long.
You finally got it.
And I had it. And they let me organize it the way I wanted it. They let me assign students to tasks and give them authority in certain elements. It was all going. It was, like, perfect. Couldn't be more perfect. And then I was making a little list of all the things that I wanted to do that year. And I remember
a little list.
It was not a little list. But usually what I would do on those same year in review lists, I used to have teaching outcomes would show up on that list. And I remember when I made my list, I stopped and looked at it, and there was nothing to do with teaching that I had listed on the, you know, if I do nothing else this year, I have to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no teaching outcomes. And I realized it's because the challenges I wanted weren't in that building anymore. And the people who, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, the people who my best teaching self emerged because I was resisting their horrible teaching practices, like, I'm going to be that change, they had left. And new, young, excellent teachers had come in to fill that void. And it was no longer like, you know, you're the only one who's going to look after those kids.
They were in good hands.
There's all these people who are, they really give a, all these give a shits showed up. And it was like, oh, well, maybe it's okay. And I remember looking at that list and being like, yeah, I don't, that's weird. That I was like, I had
so
told on myself.
It snuck up on you a little bit.
Snuck up on me. And I remember going home and saying to Tara, like, so what if I just didn't go back to work next year? And, you know, I've told this story before in different ways, but, you know, in brief, she was just like, cool.
Did she see this coming? I feel like she probably saw it coming before you did.
Yeah, she probably saw it coming before I did. As most, you know, people that love you can see right through you.
Right.
Right? So that's for sure it. But also, she didn't ask me any necessary, important logistical questions about how we would live. We were going to figure that out.
Yeah. It was going to work out.
That we were going to make that work. So that was the other thing, whereas I realized, how dare I not try? Like, that's how I felt.
Right.
If I had this opportunity, and I had a person who was supporting me, and I had finally, after all of these years, reached a place where work was coming to me that I wanted in that space.
Paid work. It's not like you're doing three graphic novels for free.
How dare I try to do it all, because it would all be a little bit worse as a result. Like, it was at that point.
Right.
My teaching was not suffering before that point. And my work on the books was not suffering before that point.
But it had reached that tipping point, where that it critical was now, juncture.
They were cannibalizing
one each had other. To start eating the other.
Yeah. And so I think that was a big move for me. Yeah.
Well,
that direction is to you. Since you're the boss. Our producer, Lyndon, who has returned to save us from our poor recording practices, has indicated to Justin
that it is time to wrap
bring it all around.
Well, yeah. So I, well.
We started by talking about work practices, and then I completely derailed it to just talk about the trajectory of my career and making choices about
partition. This is quite a journey.
Yeah, it has been a journey. But we didn't talk about you at all, Justin.
I think maybe that's next episode, because clearly there's a lot of meat here.
Yes.
But I think that's a good place to leave it off, because I think that's what the listeners of this podcast are looking for, because probably most of them have actual full-time jobs, and a lot of them are finding that, you know, that competitiveness of their passion and their... what do you call them? Disgusting essentials?
Oh, yeah. I call them repulsive essentials.
Repulsive essentials, right? Like, you know, what puts the roof over their head and what they want to, in their creative soul, work on. How do you balance those things? And I think this has been like a really good conversation of how you made those things work until it couldn't anymore. And then, yeah, you got to make some tough decisions after that. But I think that's, yeah, that's, again, what I would have loved to hear. Yeah, when I was starting out.
I wonder if the takeaway here, the wrap-up, is if your creative work that you're doing in the margins of your life is impacting your regular job negatively.
That's like my whole story was going to be about that. Yeah.
That's when you have been given the indication that maybe it's time to change up how you spend your days.
Yeah.
I think that's the takeaway there. Well, I think you, sir, should wrap up the episode.
This has been Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. My name is Justin Curry, also known the world over as Chasing Artwork. Join the fight. Make comics.
Bum, 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 bum.
I'm not used to saying it.